The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, where we discuss current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to stay on top of all the latest news from China in only a few minutes a day through our email newsletter, our handy smartphone app, or at the website at subchina.com. SubChina offers uncensored reporting from and about China, and you can read about everything from media policy to the Me Too movement, from the U.S.-China trade war to China's ongoing draconian repression of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. We assure that you'll agree that it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I'm in Washington, D.C. to record a batch of pre-holiday shows. Joining me from fabled Goldcorn Holler in Nashville, Tennessee, is Jeremy the Grinch Goldcorn, a man with a heart two sizes small, who is leading the war on Christmas, and damn it, it's his right now as an American citizen. Welcome to America, Jeremy.
Happy Festivus, sir.
yeah, exactly. Offer our listeners some more of that Grinchy atheistic holiday cheer.
Bah, humbug. On with the show.
Well, today on the show, we are very pleased to have two former ambassadors to the People's Republic of China. David Mulroney served as Canadian ambassador to China from 2009 to 2012 during the prime ministership of Stephen Harper. And Jorge Guajardo served as Mexican ambassador to China from 2007 to 2013 during the presidency of Felipe Calderon and during the first 6 months of Peña Nieto. So they were both in China during what we all think is a very important period of transition in China, the years leading up to Xi Jinping's assumption of the general secretaryship of the Chinese Communist Party and the presidency of the People's Republic of China. We are going to coax some good stories out of these two from their years there. So welcome to the show, both of you, Jorge and David.
Thank you, Kaiser. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to be with you, Kaiser.
Let's jump right in and start by talking about your time in China. As Kaiser said, those were very eventful years. You were both there. Jorge, you were there for the Tibet riots, the earthquake, the Olympics, the financial crisis. And David, you arrived for the aftermath of the financial crisis and perhaps in time for the Xinjiang uprising. And you were both there for the dramatic events of 2012, Wang Lijin's attempted defection and the downfall of Bo Xilai and much else that happened or was rumored to have happened that year. In other words, you both had the misfortune to live in very interesting times indeed. What were the major diplomatic issues that demanded your attention specifically on behalf of Mexico and Canada when you were both respectively serving as ambassadors in China?
If I may start,
yeah, please.
Three things come to mind, Jeremy, that were the main diplomatic issues when I was Mexico's ambassador to China. One was the H1N1 flu epidemic, which began in Mexico, and which China reacted in a rather harsh way and created a big diplomatic incident. They started rounding up everybody who had a Mexican passport in China, whether they had been in Mexico or not.
Oh, I forgot about
and
that.
And just putting them on quarantine, and it was a huge issue. They closed their consulates in Mexico. They canceled their direct flights. It was just a huge overreaction that just threw the relations back several decades. So that was one big issue. Another big issue while I was there was I remember Liu Xiaobo being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize at a time when, by sheer luck, my foreign minister was the only foreign official in town. And, of course, she was scheduled to have a press conference, and that was going to be the key question, so that was a big issue. And finally, and the always classic one, is my president meeting with the Dalai Lama.
Oh.
Which, as the Chinese reminded me on many occasions, it was the first time that the president of a developing country was meeting with the Dalai Lama. It was a big issue. So those were the three no small issues that probably most form my 6 years in China.
Can you remind us of the dates of that? So when was the H1N1 crisis?
The H1N1 was 2009. I'll tell you what I remember exactly of the H1N1. It was immediately after Xi Jinping was named vice president.
Mm.
And his first trip abroad as vice president or designated successor was to Mexico.
Yes,
and I accompanied him. And
was that where he gave that speech where he said foreigners have eaten too much and sit around and Chirbala Chung Dawaiguran, they shouldn't order China around?
That's exactly when he said that, and that was what I was referring to, because it was interpreted as if he was addressing Mexicans when he said that. So I remember writing, and Newsweek had a big article on how Xi Jinping had lectured Mexico on how to or how not to treat China. And I remember writing a letter to the editor of Newsweek saying, no, that was not addressed to Mexico. In fact, our relations couldn't be better. That letter was published, I think, the day of H1N1 crisis, and it all went downhill from there. So that was 2009. Liu Xiaobo was 2008. And the Dalai Lama was 2012.
My gosh, what an eventful time for you there. What about you, David? What were some of the highlights of your stay? I mean, you've actually had a long diplomatic career in China, but just the ambassadorship, let's talk about first.
So the big issue for me when I got there in 2009, and shout out to Jorge, who is a neighbor and a good friend, and was a good friend to all incoming ambassadors, and I really enjoyed his insights and his friendship. My specific challenge was that we were in the midst of a Prime Minister Harper deep freeze. Harper is a conservative. He followed the liberals. And unlike the liberals, you know, the conservatives of the Stephen Harper era were a little bit like the Republicans of, you know, the early part of this century. I mean, they weren't like their predecessors. The bi-party consensus on China between the liberals and conservatives had broken down. And he was tremendously distrustful of the Chinese, worried that Canada had become too close to China. He didn't go to the Olympics, which was considered a slight. And the Chinese were very concerned. They said, you're not like your predecessor. You don't get us. I heard the same line from all of the ministers that I called on. We were in the deep freeze. But as Jorge says, it was also the time of the economic crisis, and China was seen to be, you know, the rising tide that was lifting many boats, including the Canadian boat. So Harper was warming up, and he made a visit in 2009, just around the time of the first Obama visit, that was really a step in putting the relationship on the right track. The specific irritant for Harper was the fate of a Canadian, a Mr. Chalil, who lived in Hamilton, Ontario, but was of Uyghur origin, who had been picked up in Uzbekistan and flown into China into trial and detention. And the Chinese said, well, you know, he's not a Canadian. We think he's Chinese because he didn't use a Canadian passport. We said he didn't use a Canadian passport because you spirited him into the country from Uzbekistan. But Harper felt that the foreign ministry, of which I was a part, had been so respectful of China that they hadn't done everything they could for him. And I remember speaking to him about that and you know, saying I would do my best to get out and see his family, to see if we could get better conditions for him. And that's something I did certainly before Harper arrived. The other really significant irritant, and it had been an irritant for 10 years, was the presence in Vancouver of a man named Lai Changxing, who was a financial fugitive. He escaped, got into Canada a couple of steps ahead of the security services, and was scared into the refugee system in Canada by a clandestine delegation. A bunch of Chinese security officials, you know, pretended to be part of a trade mission, went to see him and so scared him that he went into the refugee system. And the Chinese then said, well, you know, send him home on the next plane. And we said, no, he's in the refugee determination system. We don't think he's a genuine refugee, but we have to make our case to a judge in Canada, and it's the judge who decides. That took 10 years, and with incredible consequences for the relationship, shouting by very senior Chinese leaders, a great frustration, and it only got solved towards the end of my time. And when it was solved, I remember we put the judge's decision up on our Weibo. It got taken down right away, but we put it up again, and it stayed there for some time. So it was we got out of the Harper deep freeze. Things warmed up considerably, sometimes by design, sometimes by chance. But it was also a time, I remember, when dealing with the Chinese had become different. In the past, if there was a difficult decision or a tough negotiation, even if you came out on the short end, the Chinese would leave you something, right? You didn't walk away from the table right. empty-handed. That changed, and I saw it change on my visit as ambassador, where it was zero sum, right? They were going to walk away with everything and leave you with nothing. And it was also a time when they could be much more blunt in public. They were always blunt in private, much more blunt in public than they had been in the past. So much less concerned about retaining smaller countries as friends.
When do you date the start of that change, David?
Well, I had been dealing, I date the start of that from early in this century. I was running the Asia branch in the foreign ministry from about 2001 on, and I began to see that difference. I remember once getting a call at home at about midnight, and they said, we need to speak to the foreign minister at 7 tomorrow morning. And I said, I'd really rather not call him tonight at 7 in the morning. Is there some other way of setting up this call? Because generally you give people lead. And they said, well, we're a P5 country. We're members of the Security Council. And I'd never heard the Chinese speak like that. And generally, if you are a P5 country, you don't need to remind people that you are one. But there was an edge to China, a sense of having arrived and not quite knowing how to behave when you've arrived, that I hadn't seen before. What I've always loved about China is the tremendous pragmatism of people at the working level. You can have a really difficult discussion, you can be at loggerheads, but in the end, they'll find a way and you'll find a way to get through. I didn't see as much of that on my final posting.
We will talk about that. It's interesting that you talk about two extradition-related cases related to Canadians and Chinese. It's sort of a plus échange, plus même chose kind of thing, right?
Exactly.
Maybe this is a timely time to remind people that Canada isn't the only country that has extradited. Anyway, I flicked at the fact that you had just talked about your earlier postings. David, you had a quite a bit of experience as a career diplomat with China. So let's talk about your experience. But first, I'm going to ask Jorge about how much experience he had had with China prior to his assignment to Beijing, because I think it contrasts pretty strongly with yours.
I had no experience in China. I was a political appointee. I was consul general in Austin, Texas, which of course is not a typical place somebody then moves on to China for. But the reason I was sent to China as ambassador is on the understanding that my field was mostly in commercial business. And the idea was to go and look for opportunities, for business opportunities, for Mexican exports in China, for Chinese investment in Mexico. And that's something I'd like to highlight. Mexico's relationship with China is mostly commercial. It's mostly economic. I mean, we don't have a security dialogue, or we are not in that field. We're mostly a commercial relationship, so the idea was to send an ambassador that could speak that language and look for opportunities. I spent 6 years there and failed drastically in finding any single opportunity.
Oh no. So it was baptism by fire then. I mean, you really were thrown in. How did you come up to speed on China? I mean, because these days you're very conversant.
Well, thank you. No, I read a lot. And I did read as much as I could get a hold of on China. I, of course, as soon as I arrived in China, I started visiting with most of my colleagues, sort of getting their ideas. I started traveling, I visited every single province in China, several of them many times. So it was literally trial by fire and just reading obsessively everything I could get my hands on China, and it helped.
That old blog Dan Wei was pretty good, I remember.
Exactly, Dan Wei. I've been following it since.
Yeah. That's great. And okay, what about you, David? Like I said, you had a career in diplomacy. Can you talk about your own experiences?
Sure. I started up, my first posting was in Korea at a really interesting and very difficult time, the time of the shooting down of Cal 007, the murder by bombing of half the Korean cabinet at the Martyr Shrine in Rangoon. It was just a really eventful time in Korean history. Then I studied Chinese briefly at the Canadian Forces Language School and went out to reopen our consulate general in Shanghai in the mid-1980s. We had we rented four houses in the suburbs out by the airport, out by Hongqiao Airport. The fourth was the consulate general. The other three were the homes of the three Canadians. We'd have consular cases showing up at my door on Saturday and Sunday. But we gradually, you know, reestablished our presence in East China. It was interesting. Jiang Zemin was the mayor of Shanghai in those days, and I got to meet him a number of times way back then. Then did a lot of work in the East Asia section of our Foreign Affairs Department. I was a desk officer during Tiananmen. And gradually, I ultimately became the assistant deputy minister running that branch and had a lot to do with Chinese ambassadors, including an incident where the Chinese consul general in Toronto attacked a Canadian Falun Gong supporter in the pages of the Toronto Star, the newspaper. And the Chinese, and he got sued. And the Chinese came to see me and said, well, you know, he's got diplomatic immunity. And I said, he's got consular immunity, which isn't the same thing. And again, a judge decides if this particular activity was within the ambit of his consular function. And the judge decided it wasn't. And that led to a red-faced ambassador shouting at me in my office, but ultimately the departure of the consul general one step ahead of the lawsuit. I then worked in a number of areas related to East Asia. I traveled to China with Prime Ministers Chrétien and Martin, who were liberals, and ultimately Harper. And I also ran Canada's unofficial office in Taiwan for 3 years, and the 3 years when the DPP defeated the Kuomintang and established a kind of a new era in Taiwan. That shaped in the my mid-90s. Outlook on China a little bit. Yeah, yeah. So, and China was the end of my diplomatic career. It was a wonderful posting in many respects, but it was a tough job many days.
I bet.
Yeah, right. Some of the things that you said earlier, David, I mean, it reminds me of a speech, I just have it in front of me right now. Chaz Freeman, who we interviewed on the show not too long ago, was talking about some of these same things, the sort of humility, the lack of hubris, the pragmatism that used to characterize people. Let me read a little piece I highlighted from it. Chaz said, 40 years ago, Beijing was diffident, not hubristic, but it was remarkably good at making tough choices. It also had the diplomatic skill to enlist the support of the outside world for its peaceful development. Perhaps it is impertinent for a foreigner to ask whether this is still the case. Still, once when we were arguing, Deng Xiaoping asked me what use foreigners were, Lao Wai or Shen Yongchu. His answer to his own question was that we foreigners would tell him what we thought, not what he wanted to hear. I really contrast that with what's happening now. Today, you know, Beijing wants to hear very little of what the foreigners have to say. What, Jorge, and you were both there in this pivotal period. What in your mind has really changed? And David, you've told me when you thought this was quite noticeable, and this is sort of, you've marked it a little earlier than most people would in at the turn of the last century in 2000, 2001. I know that that was before September 11th, and there was maybe a respite from that after September 11th, but yeah, I can see dating it to that too. But what about you, Jorge?
I remember. So I arrived in June 2007, and one of the things you are very quickly subjected to or submitted to is a lot of media requests for interviews, and they're usually, as you know, state media organizations, and of course, you are a new ambassador, so you want to talk and reach as many Chinese as possible, so you entertain them. And they ask all these soft questions, you know. It's always a friendly interview that would always end with the same question. What can China learn from Mexico? And you'd, of course, demur and say, well, nothing, of course. I mean, we're not here to teach any lessons, quite the contrary, you know. And
what about cooking?
Right. Really, no, but I remember after 2008, after the financial crisis, that when I took those interviews, that changed to what can Mexico learn from China?
Wow. Remarkable.
And it was very noticeable that every single interview would be what can Mexico learn from China? And it was the same answer. Well, no, nothing. I mean, we're not here to learn or to teach. I mean, we're here conducting relations. But that was a change I noticed, and it was all around the financial crisis in 2008.
Fascinating.
David and Jorge, clearly things are very different now than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And David, you're dating the change in attitude, as Kaiser said, to a little earlier than most people do. It's generally the financial crisis and the Olympics that I hear. But I'm curious what your experience has been at, not at the most senior levels of government, but in dealings with your counterparts at the foreign ministry, for instance, or among those many officials who staff the party bureaucracy, who run sections in the ministries. Some of them are Kennedy School or LSE graduates and are quite cosmopolitan. By analogy, I imagine that in Washington, you know, not everybody is a Trump supporter, that many of the U.S. government agencies and departments are staffed by, you know, normal people, and that there's a certain amount of continuity in the way that one would interact with them. Is that the case at all in China, or has this aggressive new attitude, is it from top to bottom?
I guess I'd say, you know, if you're in Ottawa, you'll find that the most hated department in town is foreign affairs. We're seen not to get the, you know, Canadian perspectives, to be haughty and supercilious. The same thing's true in China. I had many good working level contacts in relevant ministries. So the agriculture people, the people who looked at quarantine issues and could block or open the doorway for Canadian products. I remember endless conversations about the arrival of two pandas to the zoo in Toronto. This was something I would get regular calls from Ottawa. This was of great political significance. And in this case, the problem was really the Canadian zoos, who kept misunderstanding what the Chinese were saying. But we had, as a key interlocutor, a woman who had done her degree, her veterinary degree, at the University of Guelph in Ontario. And I could call her up and say, you know, Madam Wong, you know, we clearly didn't get the message. Can you help me to distill it? And she'd say, yeah, I could tell those folks didn't understand us. What I really mean is this. And, you know, step by step, we got the deal done. And I generally found that I could have someone like that in all of the key ministries that I was dealing with. And it helped when they'd gone to school in Canada, for example.
Right.
But that wasn't always the case in the foreign ministry. What I kind of admired and feared and loathed about the foreign ministry all at the same time was, and something that the Chinese are very good at, they can be extremely friendly and you know, very affable dinner companions. But when I'd get called in at night because the Dalai Lama was coming to Canada, those same people put the visors down and could be extremely tough with me. They had a way of personalizing the relationship sometimes and then being ruthlessly professional. And they're, so I've got to say, while I don't always admire the Chinese foreign ministry, they're very good at, in that respect. They get the job done.
It sounds like Americans to me.
David, I don't know if this applies to your experience with the foreign ministry, but I remember when I was summoned to the foreign ministry, usually when they were upset about something. First of all, the thing that would change is that instead of addressing me in Spanish, as they would usually do, they would speak to me in Chinese with a translator. And evidently, they were addressing the microphones in the room to make sure that they delivered the message in the harshest tone possible. And then on the way out, as they walked you to your car, they would sort of smile and say, of course, you know, it's all good, and start talking to you about future plans. And by the way, and we're going to... So they sort of told you it's all going to be good. That did started changing towards the end, in which you didn't get that follow-up on the way to the car. But I'll tell you where I did find a different version, which was in the provinces. So I remember having very, very long conversations with party secretaries like Hu Xionghua, Wang Yang, even Bo Xilai before his arrest. And they would really go out on a limb and make a point that they understood you, contrary to what Beijing was saying, and that they understood your concern. And I never really understood if that was something that Beijing was coordinating with them and asking them to relay that message, or if they were going out on a limb. But it was a different message than the one you'd get from Beijing.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's really fascinating.
I did find that. And one of the things that I would do is, you know, when we had a sensitive case, a Canadian in detention, or in one case, it was the partner of a Canadian. The woman was Canadian. Her partner was Chinese, but he had been beaten up. The allegation from the police was that he had dragged five police officers to the one part of the police station where there was no camera and assaulted them there. We doubted that. We had a visit by our Minister of Health, and she said, I know I'm supposed to raise this issue. When should I raise it? In the plenary session. And I said, if you raise it in the plenary, the minister is going to have to say respond to you in front of his entire team, and we're going to get the party line. So when we break for lunch and you walk in and you have your chit-chat with him, why don't you raise it there? Because he's a doctor. He'll understand it's a medical issue. What we want to be sure of is that this person gets medical attention. She did it that way, and he was grateful. He did take it seriously, and he did follow up. So sometimes if you can find a way to work with outside of the system and not trigger the inevitable response, the inevitable bureaucratic response, you can get results.
That's great. That's great.
Let's switch gears a bit and talk about the Trump administration's efforts to enlist other countries in pressuring China on unfair trade practices. How successful have they been, do you think? And how much have you two been privy to those sorts of efforts?
Okay, so Jeremy, if I can jump in. As we're recording this, we read the news that the Department of Justice in the United States, together with 12 other countries, are issuing indictments on Chinese nationals for cyber espionage.
It's a surprisingly small number, right?
Well, the fact that 12 would come together,
yeah, yeah,
I think it's no small thing. And I'll
no small thing at all.
China was a typical case of game theory in which no country wanted to get ahead of the other one. So, and they would all game the system. So if the U.S. picked a fight, Germany would try to profit out of that. Even within the EU, if the UK picked a fight, then Spain would try to profit. And it was always, everybody was always trying to game China's favor. And I think it's not necessarily Trump that has been able to put together this coalition. I think it's China that has been able to put together this coalition against it. And I mean, somebody
has done everything he can to sabotage it, really.
No, somebody said the other day to me, said, Trump may not be the president America deserves, but he sure is the president China deserves.
That's, can you attribute that quote to somebody? That's a pretty good one. I want to compliment them.
You know, I will tell you offline.
Okay, offline. Okay, great. And I'll send him an email and let him know. Great quote. That's hysterical. And what about you?
My sense is that to the extent that there is sort of a degree of like-mindedness being encouraged, it's really happening through the security people, what they call the Five Eyes, Canada, United States, UK, Australia, New Zealand, and spreading out from there. And that does have a trade and commercial dimension. I don't think on the trade side itself, I mean, Jorge, you'll have your views, but our conversations with the U.S. about trade have been very North American, with the exception of that little poison pill clause within the new agreement. So I haven't seen as much, and President Trump is not a coalition builder. I have been surprised, too, at how difficult it has been to find a degree of like-mindedness among Western countries. I was for 1 year the G8 Sherpa. It was during the German year, uh-huh. The Heiligendamm meeting. And at the start of the year, the Sherpas were very feisty, and we're going to talk about China, and we've got to address the issue, et cetera, et cetera. The steam had gone out of that by the time that leaders met. There's a great fear of being seen to gang up on China or to form a sort of a coalition against China. And that has, I think, precluded the possibility of really honest discussions about how we deal with China one-on-one. China has been remarkably successful in the last 20 years in isolating countries, even big countries like Britain and France. Canada certainly felt that. Norway, Sweden, Australia. And it works because, as Jorge says, you know, there's competition out there. When that happens, everybody else kind of goes to the side and says, oh, you know, tough luck, you know, good luck there, but doesn't really help. There's room to discuss a conversation with China about larger expectations, that we salute China's rise. We're happy to see the success in China, but there are expectations that go along with that. And the targeting of individual countries is something that concerns all of us. That conversation isn't happening, and it probably should.
It sort of strikes me as unfair. I mean, the Obama administration was probably trying to build just such coalitions to bring everyone on, especially with respect to Chinese cyber espionage. There were no takers, but suddenly it's switched, and it seems like Trump will get unfair credit for this.
Let me give you a contrarian point on that, that we read a lot about. It's Huawei, 5G, sure, et cetera. During the Obama administration, during all administrations prior to President Trump, there was sort of an unwritten rule with Mexico that Mexico would do all that was possible to block Huawei from building its telecommunications infrastructure. That changed with President Trump. And with all his attacks on Mexicans, sort of Mexico said, well, listen, we have no problem, we have no issues with Huawei. We don't consider ourselves a target of cyber espionage. All of a sudden started seeing the Mexican president signing telecommunications agreements with his Chinese counterpart. Where was Meng Wanzhou heading when she was arrested? She was heading to Mexico.
Yes, so, that's interesting. Yeah.
So that is something, for instance, where probably the United States is worse off now with President Trump than they were before.
Oh, that is a good point, and very good one to raise. It's interesting. It wasn't there's a $1 billion loan, or rather a credit that was given specifically for purchase of Huawei telecoms equipment, right?
That was for purchase of handsets.
But
they were sort of disincentivized to participate in the infrastructure, in the telecommunication, and that was mostly in coordination with the United States.
I see.
Because we were neighbors, because we were integrated, so on and so forth. And then in comes President Trump, and in comes all the attacks on Mexicans. And you did see a shift in the Mexican government, the prior Mexican government, sort of saying, well, why are we picking a fight with Huawei? Or why are we blocking Huawei when we're getting nothing in return from the United States? And I repeat, as opposed to the Five Eyes, and even as opposed to where Canada is, this, Mexico doesn't necessarily consider itself a target for cyber espionage or where cyber military options would be exercised. So we just see a good product, an affordable price with good financing, and we say, hey, you know, why not?
Yeah.
There's a lot of truth in that, Jorge, and I worry about the world we're going into where we'll have two, you know, rival technology systems, and consumers will lose out. Britain and Canada had been outliers in the Five Eyes in that we both adopted the idea, Britain first, of establishing testing centers that would be financed by Huawei, but where you had independent testers testing the technology. And what attracted me about that idea is the idea of risk mitigation. The problem with sometimes with the intelligence community is it's complete risk exclusion, close the door entirely. And that world, while it may make us feel safe, has a lot of disadvantages. It closes us off from a lot of good things that, dare I say it, China creates, produces, and offers us. And so the risk mitigation world offered that benefit, and it seemed to be working. Canada is a few weeks away from making its own decision on 5G. I think we're coming to the end of the risk mitigation experiment. I think the current Huawei case is the nail in the coffin. And I think we all lose in that world.
That's a real pity, yeah.
We're going to return to Huawei because obviously that is the very juicy subject at the moment. But David, just now you mentioned the poison pill in the USMCA. So there's a clause in the new USMCA that Wilbur Ross described, as you say, as a poison pill that says if either of you makes a trade pact with a non-market country, which one presumes means China, then that country can be effectively kicked out of USMCA and the other two would just become a bilateral. It would become a bilateral trade pact. Is that the right understanding? And how does that impact things with China?
David, if I may just jump in, and the only thing I would say about that poison pill, or my only complaint, is that it was not Mexico's idea. No country was displaced from the U.S. market as much as Mexico when China entered the WTO. Mexico and China are not complementary economies. We never intended to do a free trade agreement with China, so we find it brilliant. I think Canada is in a different situation, and I'll let David talk about that.
It's very advantageous to Mexico, in other words, yeah, right. And David, how do you feel about that?
So this has been very controversial in Canada, and the government has been criticized for this. I've long wondered when this day would come, when in a world that is much more difficult for Canada, our relationship with the United States is changing. It forces us in many ways to have what I call a real foreign policy, as opposed to one where the main considerations, security and prosperity, are really guaranteed through our relationship with the United States. We need to make much tougher choices. So in a way, that this is the chill wind of our future. Canadians are having a really hard time. They're tremendously distracted by Donald Trump. They, no offense, they don't generally like him very much. And they find him incredibly hard to read. And one of the problems they have is they
you and the rest of us, David.
They underestimate. I'm a very polite Canadian. They underestimate his follow-through intentions. And this is going to get tested sooner rather than later, or was going to get tested sooner rather than later. I think the Hmong arrest in Vancouver has kind of put that on the sidelines for a while, as did the very strange approach by the Trudeau government, which was to attempt to sell China on what they described as a progressive trade deal, which had, you know, issues of gender, labor, the environment, completely alien to the Chinese. The Prime Minister embarrassed himself when he was in Beijing earlier in the year. It went nowhere. So that has sort of been put on the sidelines, but the issue is still there. Australia is ahead of us in this list. You know, China is their number one economic partner. The United States is their security guarantor. And they're already facing the really tough decisions that come with living with two very powerful but contending partners. So again, I see this as the first wave of many that's really introducing this new world we're getting into.
Jorge, you're not limited by that Canadian politeness. Apparently, you've made no secret whatsoever about how you personally feel about our president. You've also, though, not been shy at all about advocating on Twitter, at the very least, for your support for a much tougher policy on China, especially when it comes to unfair trade practices. I think you have a lot of people who would agree with you on that. But how far are you willing to see Trump go on pushing back on China? At what point do you see it becoming simply counterproductive, you know, threatening broader global stability, foreclosing, you know, or at least maybe seriously complicating cooperation in areas where bilateral cooperation is really essential, where not just bilateral, but multilateral cooperation, especially on things like the environment and, you know, the other actors pressing the case against China who need to cooperate with it, like the EU? Surely they see there's a possibility of going too far. Where is that?
Well, as you will say, I hate President Trump and everything he stands for. There is no redeeming quality in my eyes regarding President Trump. None. Nevertheless, I feel awful to say every time that when it comes to China, I like what his administration is doing. Now, would it be only President Trump that would address China in that way? Probably not. Probably no. Any
the Clinton
U.S.
administration
president
would have been. Yeah, a Clinton administration would have been
probably.
Harder,
but there are a couple of things that President Trump was crazy enough to start that did change the game. Now I don't necessarily agree with those, which was to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement and to talk directly to Kim Jong-un. So those were the two things that I think China used to sort of leverage its position in all other issues is, well, yes, but you need us for climate change, and yes, you need us for the two Koreas. And in comes this president that says, oh, no, I don't care about climate change and about Korea, by the way. Oh, I'll talk to them directly. So all of a sudden, China finds itself in a position in which they don't have as much leverage as they were used to. And then he goes on and starts doing all that we know, tariffs, 232s, 301s. And I do think that is the right way to approach China. And it embarrasses me to no end to say that I was a Peter Navarro before Peter Navarro was fashionable. And that was my view of China when I was Mexico's ambassador to China, because the fact of the matter is China does game the system. China is indeed protectionist. China will not cede anything, and it is very frustrating to try to deal with them, and they will keep saying win-win, and of course we don't have any reason to want trade surpluses, but they do game the system, and they have no incentive to change. So I'm not sure they will change with President Trump, but at the very least, it's being acknowledged as such. And if nothing else, Mexico wins in this case, because by the United States addressing this imbalance, it opens opportunities for Mexico in the U.S. market, even if it's not vis-a-vis China. Now, how far should they go? In a sense, Kaiser, one of the things I like about this administration is that they have no China hands. Now, that, of course, is not the politically correct thing to say, because you're never supposed to be in support of ignorance. But I think China hands, whether they'd be the Geithners, Hank Paulsons, I mean, they create a franchise in which they're the ones who have to look out for the Chinese point of view. And in essence, the Chinese use that to their advantage. They game that. And nothing has, I think, thrown the Chinese more off their game than knowing that there is no China hand they can appeal to try to help the U.S. administration understand the Chinese perspective. And something that I always told my Chinese counterparts is that I would say China wants, in my case, a Mexican ambassador in China to explain to Mexico how Chinese are, and a Chinese ambassador in Mexico to explain to Mexicans how Chinese are. So who explains to the Chinese what Mexicans' priorities are? And that's a thing they never realize, that they are so worried about other people, other countries understanding them, that they never try to understand other countries.
Jorge, by the way, is the founding president of the organization Diplomats Against Diplomacy.
Yes, I was a political appointee, right, which, as right, most career diplomats would say, is a reason why they don't like political appointees.
David, what about you? Do you think that there's, I mean, I don't know, I'm less familiar with your positions on China's trade practices and so forth, but I don't know how you feel about the Trump administration, so maybe take a shot at that yourself. What do you think?
So one of the things I find really interesting, and I'm with Jorge on that, and I've written a lot about the need for Canada to grow up when it comes to China, to see China as all of a piece. And the current prime minister, of course, is the son of the prime minister, Pierre Trudeau, who helped to introduce the formula that enabled Canadian recognition and recognition by other countries back in 1970. He was close to Zhou Enlai, met Mao, revered China. So our current prime minister grew up in a family that had impeccable China ties, and I think has demonstrated a degree of naivete when it comes to China. What's happened, I think, particularly with the trade war, is that it's exposed a particular weakness of Xi Jinping, in that it's engendered criticism, muted somewhat, but criticism in the Chinese system that he's pushing too far too fast, and so that's a vulnerability that's worth thinking about as we go forward. Canada right now is dealing with this, the detention of a couple of Canadians and icy cold relationship with China, criticism from the government and from the state-controlled media. And a constellation of issues, Iran sanctions, extradition treaty with the U.S., detention of citizens, but that all have something common at the base. And that is, as Jorge said, the suggestion that China has been a free rider in so many respects. We've come to this point before. We wring our hands, and then China's given a pass. And the one thing that President Trump might be getting right is that maybe we don't give China a pass. if indeed there is a, you know, there's a problem when it comes to Iran sanctions and Huawei, and that's what's been alleged in courts, then we follow this to its conclusion. That has the Canadian China watching community afraid too, and there have been calls to, you know, maybe we should have just let Madame Meng go. Why do we need this? But if one of the results of this whole crisis in Canada-China relations is the message that China is going to be held accountable for what it does, and if one of the outcomes of the charges by the Justice Department is similar, that's not a bad thing.
Right.
This is a good point, I think, to bring up the big juicy question that I've been wanting to ask you, David, which is obviously about Huawei and its chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou. What do you make of this arrest, and what's going to happen next, do you think?
So one of the things that I was always fascinated and struck by the fact that China doesn't understand the Canada-US relationship. And they see it as purely a power relationship. Canada is a vassal state. You see the world, you know, from your own perspective, and then a lot of the countries around China act like vassal states. There is a power dimension in the Canada-US relationship, but it's not omnipresent. It's a very complex relationship linked by families, shared interests, shared culture, that transcends even government. But at the level of government and administration, the relations are close, cordial, and professional. And when an extradition request comes through, it's looked at by professionals in our Department of Justice. And if a case is sufficiently strong, there's an arrest. And then there's a long process that Madame Meng is already on, which, A, she's already had her day in court when it comes to a bail hearing, and she's free in Vancouver on bail, living in one of her two houses there. She has a top-flight legal team, and they will. The next step is a request from the U.S. government for formal extradition. A case has to be made to the Minister of Justice in Canada, and then there is a possibility for judicial review of that. So it's a professional, transparent process. And what this gets to, and what Canadians sometimes forget, is that as a middle power in a world that is sometimes dominated by superpowers, we rely on systems like this. We rely on rule of law. We rely on a degree of transparency and predictability. So we have a stake in carrying this out, this process out rigorously and transparently. And I'm very proud and quite convinced that we're doing that. So I think the arrest is real. We've been thrown by President Trump's statement that he might just intervene and, you know, if he can get a trade deal and free Madame Meng. That was disastrous. At first, I thought the problem would be on the Chinese side, that it would feed their suspicion. But it's also fed a lot of discontent on the Canadian side. And questioning of institutions like the extradition system, like a sanctions system. I mean, sanctions are messy and controversial, but they're better than the alternative, which is war sometimes. It's fed some discontent that really undermines the nature and the system that Canada depends on for its stability.
David, you authored a book that I apologize for not having actually read yet. It's called Middle Power, Middle Kingdom. You wrote it right after your posting in Beijing, and you talk about what Canada had done right and what Canada had done wrong in its relationship with China. Can you maybe give us a quick and dirty version of what that book was, its central thesis?
I wanted to do two things. One is to talk about the China relationship, and I had been watching it for 25 years. The other thing, which was dear to my heart, was to talk about what the Foreign Service does, because I've noticed a decline in the, you know, what we might call civics education in Canada. By the end of my posting, people didn't really understand how government worked and what, you know, diplomats did. So I wanted to share with Canadians what life was like for someone working in a China embassy. But I also wanted to talk about the China relationship as, you know, in the space of my career, it had become clearly our second most important relationship. And I'd noticed a tendency on the part of one of our major parties, the Liberals, to see China as the golden future. Prime Minister Chrétien used to say, you know, we were China's closest friend. And on the part of the conservatives, so overblown on the part of the Liberals, and on the part of the conservatives, that China was the sum of all fears. And I said that going forward, we would absolutely need to have a positive as possible a relationship with China, but that involved graduating to a new level of competence when it came to managing the relationship, and a new level of maturity in seeing China as all of a piece. So a source of great opportunity, but a really worrisome tangle of problems and challenges. And that was managing China was a first step in navigating a future that is I think, much more uncertain for us.
Mm, absolutely.
Jorge, one last question. Your new president, López Obrador, has proposed a kind of Latin American Marshall Plan that he hopes will address the root causes of things like Central American migration. And he's talking a total size of $30 billion. There's an expectation that a good chunk of that money would come from the United States, which has an obvious interest in solving some of these problems. But in a New York Times report from last week, officials interviewed said, if Mr. Trump cannot be persuaded, Mexican officials said in interviews that they would remind him that there's another player in the region willing to step into the vacuum, China. What do you make of this?
Okay, at first sight, Jeremy, I would tell you that's the typical hubristic reaction of incoming administrations, not just in Mexico, but throughout the region. New presidents always think they will be able, because they are special, to establish a new relationship with China and it'll work to everyone's advantage. They are soon thereafter disabused by the Chinese and things go back to normal, and that's the end of that. Nevertheless, the one thing that I think is worth noticing is that when he brings in China to the equation, keep in mind that these Central American countries, particularly Honduras and Guatemala, are two countries that still have diplomatic relations with Taiwan. The U.S. has been very vociferous about its displeasure with Panama, with Dominican Republic, and with El Salvador for switching from Taiwan to China. PRC. So I think in that sense, I will give credit to the incoming administration in Mexico, to the new administration, in sort of telling the United States either put up or shut up.
Well put. David, Jorge, both of you, it's just been wonderful to talk to both of you. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us. Let's go on to recommendations. But before we do that, I do want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. And if you enjoy our podcast and the other shows in the network, like the fantastic Tech Buzz China and China Econ Talk, and if you like the wide-ranging content that's on SupChina, brought to you by Jeremy's team, the best thing that you can do for us is sign up to SupChina Access. Your support makes it possible for us to keep bringing you all that reporting, all these conversations, the videos, the whole lot of it. Now, let's move on to recommendations. And Jeremy, it is our habit to begin with you, and so why break it? What do you have for us this week?
I'd like to recommend an essay in the London Review of Books by James Meek called The Club and the Mob. And he's a former Guardian journalist, and it's an essay really about the destruction in front of our eyes of the news media over the last decade or two.
Yeah, well, that's a grim topic indeed. We're doing our part to save it. Yeah, thanks. That's a great recommendation. Jorge, what do you have for us?
I'm going to recommend Mexico City for Easter break as a destination. It's particularly for your U.S. audience. It's a close direct flight. It's very affordable, great hotels, great food. And I don't mean just Mexican. I mean great restaurant scene, great service, very affordable. And during Easter break, everybody from Mexico City leaves. So the city is quiet, great museums. So it's a quick, cheap, affordable, very entertaining vacation for Easter break.
Jeremy, what do you say? Let's go.
I've never been. Good, yeah. Just I'm down the there. Road.
Yeah, let's do it. My Easter break. Yeah, great idea. I didn't know that it was vacated during Easter.
Everybody in Mexico City leaves for the Easter vacation. And literally, there is no traffic. The museums are empty. The restaurants, you can get tables. And the thing about Mexico is that it's relatively cheap. I mean, especially if you come in with dollars. So it's a very affordable. For most places in the United States, it's a 3.5-hour flight. At most. And it's a different language, different culture. So you feel as if you've gone to Europe, but you're in the neighborhood. There's no time difference. So it's an easy vacation that makes you feel you went for a long trip.
Debemos estudiar español, mi amigo. Anyway, I am going to move on. That's a great recommendation. We're gonna do that. David, what do you have for us?
Gee, I was going to say Mexico City at Easter. I hardly endorse that, but I'd say you want to have Jorge curate the visit for you. I'll go with a book, one that I've just read. It's the journals of a woman named Dorothy Day, who was in her youth, an intellectual in the Greenwich Village crowd, knew Eugene O'Neill and Diego Rivera. Later became the founder of something called the Catholic Worker, which was a radical, very progressive movement to house and help the homeless, the poor. It led thinking about causes, foreign policy issues with a very strong pacifist bent. And someone who ended up after her death as a candidate for sainthood, but someone who met just about everybody there was to meet in the course of the 20th century, and a fascinating collection of memories.
Dorothy Day.
And the book is called The Duty of Delight.
Ah, sounds terrific. I'll put it on my list. I'm going to go with an Amazon Prime original television show called Patriot. I don't know if you've seen it. It's a quirky, dark comedy about a spy family, darkly funny, wonderfully nutty. Just enjoy it. If you like the show Barry on HBO, you might really dig this. It's great. Second season just aired on Amazon Prime. So with that, David and Jorge, thanks so much, both of you, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Kaiser. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you for putting up with 6 episodes in 1 week, Jeremy. That was a pretty, I know it was a lot taking time away. We needed to edit the red paper and do all this other stuff at the year end. But thanks, man. You were a real trooper.
Thanks.
All right. Talk soon.
All right. Bye.
The Cynical Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn and edited by Jason McRonald and me. Special thanks this week to Jim Millward, who was kind enough to let us convert his dining room into our little peripatetic studio. Drop us an email at cynica@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out our other podcasts, Insights in Cynical Business Week, The Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, New Voices, China Econ Talk, and Talk and Talk. More great shows coming soon. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.